You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, what piece of advice would you give the next generation? We'll talk to the author of a new book about how he's dealt with life's struggles and words of wisdom he's passing on to his grandkids. Now, in a speech on Monday, U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai outlined the Biden administration's approach to the U.S.-China trade relationship. The speech came after a review of trade policies from the Trump era. Tai said American workers would be a key focus of Biden's vision.
When it comes to our relationship with China, what's best for American workers is growing the American economy to create more opportunity and more jobs with better wages here in the United States.
Some critics, though, say the speech lacked a clear strategy for taking on a country that doesn't play by the same economic rules always as the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see tariffs on some Chinese products end or continue? Do you think the Biden administration should have a tough approach with China when it comes to trade, or do you want to see less confrontation, more negotiation? What questions do you have about this complicated relationship? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Mary Gallagher is a professor of political science and director of the International Institute at the University of Michigan. Mary, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
What kind of concrete trade policy takeaways did you see from this speech on Monday?
Well, I thought the speech was pretty interesting, and I didn't really agree with the critics that it didn't do enough, or it was not super concrete about the Biden administration's strategy in the longer term. But she did make some pretty important statements about at least the kind of direction of the Biden administration, kind of much more strategic. I would call it sort of her speech was like giving up on China. You know, they don't expect China to change, and they don't think the previous attempts, either by the Trump administration or earlier administrations, that those attempts to sort of change China through engagement, that those haven't worked. So I thought it was a pretty interesting speech in that regard, pretty pessimistic, and, you know, just trying to develop a much more strategic approach to trading with China.
What kind of continuities have there been from the Trump to Biden administrations, especially when it comes to things like tariffs on products from China?
Well, most importantly is, of course, that the tariffs have continued. And in her speech on Monday, Ambassador Tai referred to the phase one agreement that they're going to look for enforcement of that agreement if they want to see that China meets the goals that it promised the Trump administration in January 2020. So that was a pretty important continuity. I don't think that the Biden administration thinks that the Trump administration's implementation of their strategy was very effective, you know, kind of alienating allies and not doing much except these unilateral tariffs. But they're going to use them as something that they have in their toolbox. So there was some pretty important continuity. She also announced the continuation or the restart of a targeted tariff exclusion program so that firms, American firms that are being hurt by the tariffs, that they can now apply for the tariffs to be relaxed or for certain products that they need for production.
Right. The idea there being if I have a company and I can only get my raw material from China, I might be able to get that tariff exemption. Do I have that right?
Exactly.
Now, looking at the big picture here, it seems like a general consensus that China doesn't play by the rules when it comes to international trade. What are some of the specific things that you see China doing that aggravate these relationships?
There's a lot of different aspects of the Chinese economy that really don't fit well into the global economy as it was sort of constructed by the United States and other Western market economies. And some of these characteristics of the Chinese economy have been sort of doubled down upon in China's current administration, Xi Jinping. So much more focus on the state sector, the state-owned enterprises, which continue to make up a pretty big chunk of the Chinese economy. Other types of policies like the use of subsidies to target industries that China really wants to expand, Ambassador Tai mentioned several of those industries in her speech, including solar panels, steel going back all the way to the 1990s, and then most recently semiconductors. And then there are other things that have long been problems in the U.S.-China relationship, including intellectual property theft, as well as the use of dumping. So goods that are produced very cheaply being dumped into the U.S. market. And the dumping is important not because, you know, China has cheaper production costs, but part of the reason why China has cheaper production costs is their workers have very low wages and environmental protection is very weak.
Talking to Mary Gallagher from the University of Michigan, political scientist there, looking at U.S.-China trade relations, a speech from a key trade official in the U.S. this week, setting a new course. You could join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Mark is with us in Altoona. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having the program. I was just wondering if your guest could comment a bit on the positive effects of some of the tariffs, such as how we are getting undercut by state-sponsored aluminum, and the aluminum production in the United States is becoming at risk for not being able to exist, which, you know, we don't want to be too dependent on a foreign power that you may end up in a conflict with or whatever. So I was just curious about, and I don't agree with all the tariffs, but there seemed like there were some tariffs that were just really needed to protect manufacturing and, you know, ability to defend ourselves.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Mary, Mark brings up a really key point there. The Trump administration had invoked strategic needs, like Mark was talking about, for tariffs, not just on China, but allies like Canada and the European Union as well. How big a part of the story is that, where we want to make sure we can keep producing aluminum if, say, we have a very unfriendly relationship with China in the future?
I mean, I don't disagree, and I think that in some cases tariffs can be effective. I think for the longer term, I don't think tariffs are a great tool, mainly because they increase the cost of production, they increase the cost of consumers. But in terms of things like aluminum, I think one thing that the Biden administration might want to focus on, and it seems like this is something that she mentioned in the talk, is that it's much easier for the United States to find kind of common ground with other market economies like the European Union or with Canada. And if they can find a joint policy around aluminum production, and then they can work together targeting China, because China isn't playing by the rules, that's a much more effective long-term policy. But in the short term, I think that probably in some areas the tariffs have been successful. Of course, as we all like to point out, is that the tariffs do tend to increase prices on U.S. consumers no matter what. But she made some important remarks, I think, in the question and answer section of her speech about, you know, working with the European Union on this. And of course, I think she also said in the speech that she was flying to Paris right after to go to an OECD meeting. So it does seem like there is more conversation with important allies.
Mark, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I want to listen more now to U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai in that speech on Monday.
Even when China changed the specific practices we challenged, it did not change the underlying policies, and meaningful reforms by China remained elusive. In recent years, China's leaders have doubled down on their state-centric economic model.
And there, Mary, is that state-industry model that you were talking about earlier. I mean, does the United States, does anybody outside of China really have that much leverage on China to get them to move away from that core model?
I don't think we have that much influence over the domestic politics right now that are going on in China. I think that we have an interest in how those things are resolved. And certainly the parts of Chinese society and the economy that traditionally would be more kind of pro-globalization, pro, you know, better relations with the United States, those people are not in the they're not very vocal right now, let's say, in China. This kind of state capitalist model is definitely dominant. Xi Jinping, the leader of China and the head of the Communist Party, is certainly doubling down on it, as she said in the speech. I do think that long term, that system will not be successful. But we have to show that the other system, the market system, is successful. And that, I think that's the challenge that the Biden administration faces. And I think part of the reason why Catherine Tai's speech was a little bit maybe not concrete is that a large part of the Biden agenda is about our domestic agenda. So we can't really formulate a very strategic and concrete trade policy with China until the infrastructure plan and these other bills are passed, and or if they're passed.
We're talking to Mary Gallagher, professor of political science, director of the International Institute at the University of Michigan. She's with us today to talk about the U.S.-China trade relationship. The Biden administration laid out some of its approach earlier this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Has your business been affected by tariffs against products coming from China? Do you think those tariffs should stay or go? Do you have questions for our guest about how the Chinese economy works, how it's different from the U.S., why that creates clashes in the world of trade? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about the Biden administration's strategy on trade with China. Mary Gallagher stays with us from the University of Michigan. You can join in with your thoughts, questions about tariffs on products from China, what you want to see from the trade relationship. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Heather is with us in Madison. Heather, hello.
Hi, guys. My question concerns the climate change factor and how we're going to play that out in the relationship. When you look at the cost of producing something in China, it's not just the input cost of the raw materials or what they're paying their workers. It's about transporting the materials to and from and, you know, the carbon cost and all that kind of thing. So, you know, how that's going to play into the relationship, I think, is something that hopefully they're thinking about and the strategy of that.
Interesting question. Thanks for the call, Heather. Mary, climate change and how the U.S. and China deal with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people believe that climate change is actually one of the bright spots or potential bright spots in the relationship because it's really an area of common interest. We can't solve climate change without both countries being invested. But I think there are a lot of challenges, and some of it is just the short-term thinking of companies. I mean, if companies are thinking just about the bottom line or the cost of, you know, the widget that they produce being cheap as possible, then we can't change their behavior. And, you know, consumers obviously play a role in that because we need to ask questions as consumers about where the products come from and what their carbon footprint is. I think there's some push for having more information, you know, when we buy something about not just the price or maybe where it's made. And then you can think about, is this made with, you know, labor that's been forced or something like that? But also, you know, what is the carbon footprint. I think COVID-19 and also the increasing concern about climate change is starting to change how corporations think about supply chains, right? That we might need supply chains that are not just super cheap or super efficient, but also are just more reliable. And I think we'll see over the course of the next few years how supply chains might really change. And that may mean that some, you know, production does revert back to the United States, but it's unclear to me whether that's going to be a huge increase in U.S. jobs because, of course, another thing that's happening at the same time as all this trade is automation and technological change.
Thanks a lot for that call, Heather, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Jim in Cedarburg. Jim, hi.
Hey, thanks, guys. I'm wondering if the guest shares my concern about China's saber-rattling about Taiwan. Taiwan produces the most chips. Should it form a naval blockade around Taiwan? Chips couldn't get out. What would that do to worldwide economy? I wonder what the guest thinks.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Talk about computer chips there. Worried about China disrupting that flow. And as we've already learned, disrupt the flow of computer chips in Taiwan. It has a lot of spillover effects. Your thoughts on that, Mary?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I do share Jim's concerns about what's happening in Taiwan and around Taiwan. There were a lot of excursions into Taiwan's airspace over the national holiday, which is just ending in China. With semiconductors, you know, Taiwanese firms and, you know, Taiwan is a entity that used to be part of Imperial China. It's kind of complicated, but after World War II and the Chinese Civil War, Taiwan is sort of de facto independent from the mainland and is a democracy and is an important economy in its own right. And Taiwanese firms produce the most sophisticated semiconductors in the world, along with some U.S. firms, South Korean and so forth. I think that the broader concern about Taiwan is not about access to the chips, because the chips can be made elsewhere. The major Taiwanese firm that that is in this business is just is opening a plant in Arizona. So there's a move to move some of this production to the United States. There already is some. But the bigger concern, of course, is that we go to war with China over the sovereignty of Taiwan, because China has said that this is a part of China, a province of China that should be unified with the mainland. And increasingly, I think they show some impatience over the fact that Taiwan has remained separate from the mainland for, you know, for many, many decades.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Gallagher, political scientist at the University of Michigan, looking at U.S.-Chinese trade relations after a big speech from a key trade official earlier this week. Still time for your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Mary, there have been calls for, you know, some kind of like united approach of the United States and other Pacific trading partners to build an agreement to kind of rival China in the region. Sounds like the Trans-Pacific Partnership we had in the works. It was political poison for people running for president. What are your thoughts on the collapse of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and what it means now for trade with China?
That's a great question. And so the TPP has gone on after the United States dropped out. It was something that Donald Trump did in his, I think, first day in office. But, you know, importantly, in the 2016 election, neither the two major parties, neither one of them supported the TPP, even though Hillary Clinton had negotiated it as Secretary of State. And then, of course, in the 2020 election, too, hardly any, I think really none of the major contenders for the Democratic presidency, for, you know, who ran against Biden, supported it either. So this is a big problem, because the fear that I have is that the Pacific economy is going to grow more closely integrated and the U.S. will be left out. Now, China just recently in the last couple of weeks announced that it's applying to join the new version of the TPP. I think that will sort of ruin it, but because China can't really accede to all of the different conditions that it has, particularly in labor and the environment. But I think the United States, we need to think hard about trade, because if we turn away from trade, that may sound good right now because we feel like trade has only hurt us, but it's not really the case that it's only hurt us. It actually has helped a lot of regions in the United States. It's helped a lot of workers. But we did not do enough in the last couple of decades to really respond to the regions, like the regions in Michigan, like the regions in Wisconsin, that were really fundamentally injured by trade. So I think the United States needs to do some hard thinking about how can we make trade work for Americans.
And Mary, back in the late 1980s, I was at your university in Ann Arbor taking classes in your department, and there was a notion that if we engage China fully in trade, that's going to help build a middle class, they're going to develop expectations of prosperity and being represented in government, it will sort of naturally help erode authoritarianism in that country. And it seems like from this speech, as you referred to earlier, we're giving up on that notion. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, I think that's a good summary of the turnaround. And it's amazing that you know, the first policymakers to sort of announce the failure of engagement wasn't Donald Trump. It was people in the Obama administration. And so, you know, it's interesting given how polarized we perceive our domestic politics. The continuity between Obama to Trump to Biden is pretty clear, at least with U.S.-China relations. And so one of the struggles that I think the Biden administration is going through right now is we see that engagement has, as she said, created no meaningful reform in China, particularly right now. What do we do to deal with that? We can't ignore China. I mean, the idea that we can just decouple and pretend like China doesn't exist, that is impossible. But I think there is very clear bipartisan recognition that engagement hasn't worked.
In our last minute or so, Mary, what are you watching for next in this relationship?
Well, you know, one of the reasons why the general atmosphere in Beijing after Ambassador Tai's talk was I think relatively optimistic, and of course that feeds into critics of Biden, the Biden administration, that he, you know, is going to sell out to China, which I don't think is the case at all. But I do think that she was being strategically kind of maybe nice or at least not mean, because there will have to be some negotiations about the trade war. And just more recently announcing that Xi Jinping and President Biden will meet in a virtual summit. So I do expect that there's going to be at least some more negotiations and more discussions, which I think are really important. I mean, these are the two major economies in the world. They can't not speak to each other.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
That's Mary Gallagher, professor of political science, director of the International Institute at the University of Michigan. She was with us today for a look at the Biden administration approach to trade with China. Coming up, is the pen mightier than our problems? Our guest has some tips for writing things down to help solve the decisions, the tough situations we face in life. We'll look at that and other advice he has for the next generations. And we want to hear what advice you would pass on to kids or grandkids of your own. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, Johnson & Johnson has asked the FDA to approve booster shots of its COVID-19 vaccine. The company filed its request this week at a time when the government's expanding the booster campaign to millions of Americans. Answers to your questions about boosters, vaccines, and a promising pill that might help put the pandemic behind us. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, our next guest says the written word is especially powerful when it comes to helping you work through problems. By writing down what you're up against, you can sum up your problems, clear your mind, and take some action. Writing things down is a major theme running through our guest's new book, which includes a wide variety of life advice he's passing down to his grandchildren. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is one piece of advice that you would want to pass down to the younger generation in general, your kids or their kids? What's a piece of advice you maybe received from a parent or grandparent that stuck with you over the years or helped you through a tough time? Is there advice you wish you'd gotten when you were younger? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Arnie Witkin is a speechwriter, public speaking coach, mentor, executive coach, and author. His new book is called It's Not a Big Thing in Life, Strategies for Coping, Considerations for My Adult Grandchildren. Arnie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
I think a lot of us may have thought of, you know, what life lessons we'd want to pass on to another generation. You actually ran with it and put it all into book form. What inspired you to want to do that?
Rob, I've been thinking about the meaning of life for the last 60 years or so and writing down all my thoughts. And one day I put them into a Word document. There were about 20 pages of bullet points. It was about 2.5 years ago. And I gave it to the granddaughter of a friend of mine who was starting university. I said, there may be some things here which could be useful to you. She took it away and she came back and she said, listen, this cannot be for your grandchildren. It's got to be for the whole world. So that gave me a thought, and then I started expanding the book. It took me about a year and a half until I produced something which I think is readable. I would like to say, although it says for my adult grandchildren, it's actually for everybody at any age. It was just called Considerations for My Grandchildren, because that was how I wrote the first 20 pages.
Now, you wrote the book, and one theme through the book, something that comes up a few times, is the idea of when you're facing a problem, adversity, a tough decision, taking the time to write it down is something you found to be very valuable. Why is that? Why does that help?
Rob, you've got a problem, and what happens is that you've got a whole lot of ghosts floating around in your head. What if this? What if that? Should I do this? What if I fail? What will people think? And all these things are floating around. When you actually write them down, they become concrete. You can see them. You can see the what ifs. And what happens is that when you write it down, a clear strategy becomes available to you. Now, you got a problem. My suggestion to your listeners is, the first thing you say, okay, I'm responsible for myself and for getting something done about this problem. Now, there are problem-solving modules on the internet. One of the ones I use is the GROW model, G-R-O-W. You can look it up on the internet. What's your goal? What outcome do you want? What's the reality, the R? What resources do I have? Who do I know? What's in my control? What obstacles are there? How do I overcome them? And you just write down everything. Anything you can think of. Stream of consciousness. You don't hinder yourself or stop yourself or judge yourself. Then you arrive at what options do I have? The O. The more options, the better. And what I've found every single time, and all my mentees, exactly the same thing. One of the options becomes absolutely clear. It's like those pop-up books you get. You know, you open the page, and out comes the castle and the trees and the people, and you know which option to take. You just know it. And then W is, what's your will? What are you going to do? Now, Rob, this doesn't sound like rocket science because it's a fairly simple thing to do in theory. But it does take focus and it does take energy to actually do it. And in all the years I've been mentoring, and I've mentored some seriously top business people, in their businesses, of course they write everything down, they produce massive reports. But in their personal lives, very, very few people actually do it. And if your listeners get nothing else out of this interview, I would say to them, if you write things down and you come up, the more choices you have, the better. It will change your life, I guarantee it. Because what happens, you go from anxiety to action. Everything about my book is about action. And you go from not knowing where to start to making plans to do something.
We're talking with executive coach and author Arnie Witkin about his new book. It's called It's Not a Big Thing in Life, Strategies for Coping, Considerations for My Adult Grandchildren. He's offering advice not just to his own adult grandchildren, but to future generations. One big piece of advice, the value, as you just heard, of writing things down to sort out problems and tough decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is one piece of advice you want to pass down to a younger generation, or maybe that you received from a previous generation? And do you use a process of writing of some sort to help you make sense out of your life, maybe even at a tough time in your life, whether it's an organized process like our guest was talking about, or some form of diary keeping or journaling? Join in with what you do at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about advice and problem solving with Arnie Witkin, author of the new book, It's Not a Big Thing in Life, Strategies for Coping, Considerations for My Adult Grandchildren, talking about advice we can give from one generation to another. 800-642-1234 is the number to call if you want to join the conversation, maybe with advice that you've given, want to give to future generations, or maybe received from parents, grandparents, or others. 800-642-1234. Jody is with us now in Milwaukee. Jody, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me. I wanted to share some advice that my mom gave to me when I was younger. I was bummed when she picked me up from a friend's birthday party because I was one of the first to get picked up. And she told me it's best to always leave the party while you're still having fun. And that's just always stuck with me.
Oh, instead of letting it get to the point where it's not fun anymore?
Exactly.
I love it, Jody. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oh, fun advice there. Arnie, what do you think?
Well, you haven't got time to write things down there. So I think it's great advice.
Thank you so much, Jody. I wanted to ask you, Arnie, a lot of your advice in your book is about preparing people to deal with tough times. We're all going to deal with something at one point or another in our lives. You talk about your battles, plural, with cancer. What kind of advice do you have, especially for younger people, about, you know, the challenges they're going to hit at some point?
Okay. Rob, this particular advice about writing things down works exceptionally well the more difficult the problem is. Because the more difficult it is, the more you've got random thoughts running through your mind, and you've got obviously difficult feelings about them, and therefore to neutralize the feelings or to negotiate with the feelings, you can write them down. And you talk about cancer, which, as you mentioned, I've had a few bouts. I was in dreadful pain after radiotherapy, and I was complaining, I was wallowing in self-pity. I thought, oh my God, am I going to die? So I picked up a piece of paper. By the way, you can do it on computer. and I put down a heading. What is my strategy for coping? What am I going to do about this? What is my plan? And I came up with my strategy for coping, which was, number one, count my blessings. Now, if somebody says to you, when something terrible happens, count your blessings, you want to shoot them, right? But when you say it to yourself, it's got huge power. So that when I counted my blessings, it was hard to feel the pain. The second one was, don't wallow in self-pity. Don't moan or complain. Because all that does is it makes the person that you're complaining to feel helpless. So that's different from saying, I'm not feeling good today, but I'll be okay. Number three was acceptance. If it's not in your control and there's nothing you can do about it, acceptance. That was very important to me. Another one was sense of humor. Now, it's hard to have a sense of humor when you're in a lot of pain. But sometimes I used to just burst out crying, actually, because it was so painful. And then I would catch myself and I would say to my wife, if I can't get wetness in my mouth, because the radiotherapy is on my throat, I said, at least I can get it from my eyes. And also, I couldn't speak for 3 years. I spoke in a high-pitched whisper, and I used to go to board meetings, and I used to wear these very brightly colored shirts. And I would say, the loudness of my shirt makes up for the softness of my voice. And the other thing was, I wrote down certain mantras, like I would look in the mirror and say aloud, I love you exactly as you are. I care for you in this difficult time. I am strong. I will get through this. And when I said, I love you exactly as you are, there was a double feeling. The one was sort of being loving, like the adult, but the other one was the feeling of being loved, like a small child, being hugged. It's okay. You know, it's okay. And I care for you in this difficult time as well. It's acknowledgement. It's a difficult time, but I felt nurturing towards myself. And I'm strong. I will get through this. That was for grit. That was for determination. That was for steel. And that was for resilience. And when I wrote all these things down, what happened was I just coped so much better, and that stood me in good stead. Well, that was 20 years ago to start with. I still have cancer, but it's slow moving. But that strategy for coping that I wrote down resonates with me very, very often. And it doesn't only apply to things like serious illness or cancer, whatever. It can apply to major life events, major difficult traumas. And so, you know, writing things down just made me cope with my life much better. But I've used it for everything, Rob. Business deals, personal things, things with my children, simple decisions. I do it all the time.
We're talking to Arnie Witkin. His new book is called It's Not a Big Thing in Life, Strategies for Coping, Considerations for My Adult Grandchildren, sharing advice for future generations from his life, the value of writing things down in tough times. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Marshall is with us in Madison. Marshall, hi.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yep, loud and clear, Marshall. Go ahead.
Okay, good. So when I was in college, my very first professor, very first class, he was retiring, and what he wanted to say was that, you know, how people will shuffle and from class to class when they're in college and they're always looking down. He was he was very adamant that we needed to look forward or look up. And I don't know what his reasoning was at the time, because it was a decade ago, but I like to think that it's so that you don't miss the different things that are happening, because if you're just walking class to class looking down, you just see concrete. But if you look up, you see trees and different people and backpacks and coats and the sky and birds. And it's just a much better experience to look forward and up rather than just down.
Marshall, thanks a lot for that. That's interesting advice. Arnie, do you have thoughts on that idea of appreciating the world around us, not getting bogged down in shuffling from one place to another?
Yes, I very much do, Rob. And I think that what that has to do as well is creating an aura around yourself. Because when you look down and you look defeated and hangdog, you know, who wants to be around that? Whereas if you stand tall or walk tall, head up, this attracts people to you. So I think it's fantastic advice, because it makes, apart from anything else, it makes you feel good about yourself. And everybody wants to feel good about themselves, everybody in the universe. So I think it's fantastic advice.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go now to Dave in Oconomowoc. Dave, hi. Oop, Dave. There we go. Dave, yeah. Sorry, we didn't have you on the line. Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, that was weird.
That was on our end. Go for it.
Hey, it happens, even to the best of us. So everyone is going for their dreams, and everyone says, follow your dreams. And I get that. And that's great. However, when you're pursuing your dreams, especially if they're big, you're going to run into naysayers. People are going to say, you know what? What are you doing? You can't, you know, run for Congress, or you can't, I don't know, be a rock star. People are going to say that. And what the advice is, watch out, because it's the people that are closest to you. And you want to listen to your mom and dad, but sometimes you got to know when to say, you know what? I hear you, but I'm going for it.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Arnie, what do you think about that? When we get that negative input on what we want to do, sometimes the negative input might be right. How should we deal with that, do you think?
This reminds me of my father, who used to play cricket. I mean, not much played in Green Bay, Rob.
But true.
One day my father said to me, be careful of the fast bowlers. Now, in cricket, the fast bowler bowls the ball like a pitcher, and the ball comes at your head. Now, what was happening is that he was talking about himself, because he was once hit on the head by a so-called fast bowler. Now, every statement in the universe, including this one, reflects entirely on the person doing the saying. So when somebody says to you, it'll never work, you're crazy, do something different, they're not talking about you at all. They're talking about their own perception. And they might be talking about their fear. And that the last thing you should do is, if you really do have a thought out dream plan, actually it doesn't have to be that thought out, then you need to follow that dream. You need to follow that vision, because you've got to understand that whoever's telling you anything is a reflection of what they are thinking and not what you should or shouldn't be doing.
That's all the time we have, Arnie. We'll leave it there. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Rob. It's gone so quickly.
It has. Arnie Witkin is a former business leader, now wears a number of hats, including executive coach. His new book is It's Not a Big Thing in Life, Strategies for Coping, Considerations for My Adult Grandchildren. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, keep watching the skies. Get a preview of fall meteor showers and the best days and times to watch for them. That's tomorrow at 7 on the Morning Show. Up next, it's news. Then, if you have a tough time making up your mind lately, you're not alone. We'll look at the psychology behind decision fatigue and why it's gotten worse during the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.